coming round, suffering popularity breakdown. I think it's funny that I got harassed when I'm walking the streets, walking down the streets, walking down ass with the kids in the back way. I said, if you can't dance to this, doesn't matter. If you can't dance to this, it doesn't matter. I was running around with my head in the sand, looking for people and a new fan. Told me before, baby, do your own dance, stay off the highway.
What do we do when we don't start at the same place? 'Cause you had your heart stuck somewhere else before I came. I know it's all inside my head, but it's hard to look past. 'Cause she's in your past tense and I'm in your present, but I keep looking back. How do I know you're holding How can you say that you love me now when you loved her first? I know it's all inside my head, but it's hard to look past. 'Cause she's in your past tense and I'm in your present, but I keep looking back. Keep looking back, yeah, 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 yeah. But all you've shown me is how you love me, despite all my flaws. And all you've shown me is how you love me through all that you've done.
Hello and welcome to Unseated Airwaves. Oh, sorry. Audrey was supposed to say that. That is totally my bad. This is a show hosted by the Indigenous Collective at CITR 101.9 FM. And CITR is located on the unceded, stolen, occupied lands of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people in the city that is occupied by settler forces and known as Vancouver. We broadcast all the way out to the unceded, traditional, also stolen, also occupied territories of the Squamish and Tsleil-Waututh people in this same region that is so-called Vancouver. And this is a radio station, CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Danny. I use she, her pronouns, and I'm joined with a few friends in the studio today from the Indigenous Collective.
Hello, I'm Audrey. I use she, they pronouns. I'm from the Tsimshian Nation in northern BC. Happy to be here today.
Hi, I'm Cooper. I use he, him pronouns, and I'm Red River Métis from Treaty 1, Winnipeg, Manitoba.
Hi, everyone. I'm Aditya. I use he, him, and I'm from Mangalore in India.
And also, I'm Métis Cree settler. And today, we're going to be talking about Indigenous students in UBC. But first, we'll be talking about just any updates from campus. What's going on? What have you guys been to? Did anybody go to the horror movie night?
I think that's this Thursday, right?
This Thursday.
The Slashback one?
Oh, I thought it was last Thursday.
Yeah, okay. It's this Thursday. Oh, I'm planning to go.
What are the details?
It's with Indigenous Arts Undergraduate and the UBC Film Collective, I believe, is the like collaboration, and I think it's at the Norm Theater on campus. It's like they're showing, it's called Slashback, I believe it's an Inuit horror movie, and then they're following it up with another one, but they're not sure which one yet, but it sounds fun. It
sounds amazing.
Yeah, we have a poster for it on the back of the door there, and a few looming around CITR. So I thought that was really cool. I can't make it. I can't make any of the Film Sock screenings this semester because I have a 3-hour seminar every Thursday night that I have to go to. So I miss all of them, which is really sad. But anything else? Any performances anyone's going to or anything like that? I should read up on the talking stick before I do the beginning part because there's probably some stuff in there.
I can pull it up.
Anything, any recent happenings? And also, in saying our land acknowledgement, we also say Free Palestine as well. Because you should totally stand with one if you stand with the other. And do we have any updates? Or should we get into it?
Maybe we should just.
Okay, so first, in talking about Indigenous students in UBC, a lot of the previous years, till like the late 90s or whatever, the how they defined Indigenous student was only, quote, status Indian students. But then now the term encompasses status Indian students, self-identified First Nations, Métis, and Inuit students. So the terminology and what they're referencing does change. And in the beginning, when they talk about like known Indigenous students at UBC or anything like that, that's only status First Nations students from the time. And at UBC, I learned while researching for this that Musqueam land was directly stolen in order to build UBC. The lands past Point Grey were originally set aside in the local colonial settlement projects, and then they were left to the Musqueam until they were sold to the university endowment lands. So these lands were settled to build the university that we are at right now. And we'll be going over UBC's historic timeline that they've given, and with some editing and not including all of it, because there's a lot of stuff in there. And then some stuff about life as an Indigenous student at UBC today, and then some of the first Indigenous students at UBC and their stories. To start, I want to show a video or play a video that's about Musqueam protests in the creation of Pacific Spirit Regional Park, which is a park that borders UBC, and a lot of people don't know this history. I didn't until very recently, but it has been heavily protested by the Musqueam First Nation. And then after that, we'll play a video that is about the Thunderbird and UBC and a bit of its history. So first off, here's the video from CBC, and it's called Musqueam Protest at Pacific Spirit Regional Park.
With close to 2,000 acres, it's the largest urban park in the world. It's unspoiled, the forest at its best. Today's the day it's officially declared a park, and there's a professional touch to the celebrations. But the Musqueam, who first lived on the land, don't share the enthusiasm. They say this regional park should not have been created, especially not before the Musqueam's claim to the land had been decided by the courts.
It's unfortunate you have a government in British Columbia that treats the natives as they do. I think they have contempt for the native communities, have contempt for the courts in carrying out what they're doing.
The Musqueam are determined to express their opposition, as a host of speakers discovers. But most of their wrath is reserved for one man.
I realize that not everyone may agree with the establishment of the largest urban park in the world. But 50 years from now, our children and our children's children will realize, as we do for Stanley Park today, that it was the best decision ever made.
The new name is not a hit either. premier says he respects the Indians' right to protest, but he says land claims won't get in his government's way.
We can't stop the province. We can't stop doing things. We can't stop prospering or trying to create jobs and opportunities or parks for people. That's all a part of governing and moving ahead.
But the Musqueam say this is a step backward. They say they'll take their case to the Governor General. Their final sign of displeasure today is a war dance. Bill Amos, CBC News, Vancouver.
Welcome back. So, thoughts on this video and this guy?
I thought kind of towards the end of the video when he said, like, oh, this is all a part of governing. This is about moving ahead, as if, like, Indigenous people wanting the rights to their land is like something of the past, and like that's not something that's considered like modern or like relevant anymore. It's just, it's so like, oh, I don't even have like words, but it's just such like a clear example of like the ongoing elimination of Indigenous people, and just like in their face saying like, it doesn't matter, like, you living on this land and wanting this land for your own is a thing of the past. Like, we need to move forward. Like, that's just such a crazy thing to say.
It's wild. And this is all, like, what they're still doing in private but would never say out loud anymore. Like, they're still doing all of this stuff. This is still what UBC's policies are. This is still how they view these things, but they wouldn't be caught dead saying it publicly. Which is, like, one of the most frustrating things of watching that. Is like, oh, like just that like ringing in my head of like, for the next, in the next 50 years, your children's children will be glad that this is here. Well, Musqueam people are yelling at him and he's literally like proudly saying it. But yeah, any other?
Yeah. He said that it would be the best decision ever. It's such a pretty bold claim, especially like even in the same sentence you were saying before, when he was talking about how we need to move forward, he was also said something about how we can't stop the province, which is a funny claim for the premier.
The province.
Which seems like the person who is the province.
Yeah.
Sorry, I kind of interrupted you.
Oh, no. But yeah, I was going to say that as you guys were talking about the how our institutions are going to continue to do things like this, but they don't admit it. This guy pretty boldly said, just like we did with Stanley Park, we're doing this here, and it's going to be like the best decision ever. And also, in the video, they didn't really like ask, or like, they didn't really explain why the Musqueam were protesting. They just, they had like a lot more detail from him, from the premier. And so, yeah, then that just makes it look like they're protesting over nothing.
And the terms like wrath, he's like very intentionally trying to make it sound pretty evil. And in looking more into this, I saw that an account of when they realized they started there needed to be protest of it is when they were conducting ceremony that had happened in the park for like since time immemorial, and joggers and families started walking in on the ceremonies. And that's when all of this came to be, and that's not included in that video. But the fact that that's still, there's joggers and families there right now, probably, and no ceremony right now, which is very, so upsetting. And this is the kind of stuff that UBC doesn't talk about. And they have some stuff that they put out. A lot of the stuff that I'm using today is stuff that UBC themselves has put out, which has made it quite difficult. Because they want this image of that they're very critical of their histories. But it's through a very refined lens. And there's this series on their YouTube channel, The Power of a Name, that explores, quote, the contested history of naming practices at UBC's Totem Park residence and revitalizes stories of UBC Indigenous relations. So some of these videos and how they go about it is not really confronting real history, but this video provides some context to things you might see around UBC. So I'm going to skip to 2 minutes, and then we'll be talking about some things that are around campus.
Quagyos. And Quagyos are just one of the 16 tribes of the Kwakwaka'wakw people. A And so the word Kwakwaka'wakw actually comes from our language and means, literally translated, Kwakwala speaking people. And Kwakwaka'wakw is actually a really modern term that our old people came up with, because I think their feeling was they didn't want to be called Indian, they didn't want to be called Native, they didn't want to be called First Nations or Aboriginal. We're Kwakwaka'wakw. So the old people gave us that word so that we could refer to ourselves that way. So we're standing in front of my grandmother's Victory Through Honor totem pole, and you can see from the designs on the pole, there's a thunderbird at the top. And the reason why she wanted this totem pole to be placed here at UBC was because the athletics teams were already calling themselves Thunderbirds. And she really wanted them to have that name legitimately through our traditional system. So what she did was she consulted with our family members, which included Chief William Scow, who would have been one of her uncles, and talked about creating a pole that's based on our family legend. So the legend of Tse Kume is the legend that she drew from in order to create this pole. The legend of Tse Kume, which means cedar man, comes from our Kwikwisatinuk, or Guilford Island, side of our family. And so it's really fitting that that particular story was adapted for this particular pole, because the story talks about how Tse Kume was put through many tests. He was cut into pieces and thrown into the fire. He was had rocks and boulders attached to his legs and thrown into the ocean. And so he went through these different trials, but he always returned victorious, and he always overcame all of those challenges. So it's a really wonderful story about the human condition and about meeting great challenges and still continuing on. So we were really happy to learn about the legend many years later and find out that that's what she had in mind when she made the pole. My grandmother, Ellen Neal, her Kwakwala name was Kakasolas, which means people came from all directions to seek her advice, and which was a really fitting name because she was trained by my great-grandfather, her grandfather, Charlie Yakutlas James. And even though it wasn't typical for women to be carvers back in that era, she was one of the oldest children in the family, and so she was taught to carve. So she did make a living off of carving and continued pretty much through her whole life being a carver. Back in 1948, when this pole was originally carved, my grandmother, along with Chief William Scow and the late Judge Alfred Scow, when he was still a student here at UBC, presented the pole to the Alma Mater Society. And it was during the halftime at the homecoming game. And we thought that was really wonderful to hear about that as well, because everyone got to see and hear how the name Thunderbird came to be attached to the UBC teams. So I think that UBC is really fortunate to have probably the first example of a really good exchange between First Nations and non-First Nations institutions on mascot names.
Well, I thought it was really interesting when I saw the pictures of my parents, and Alfie Scow, Chief Alfred Scow, was there as well representing the Tribal Council. And I looked at the date on it and I went, oh, this was all done in 1948 and I was 1 year old, the baby of all the Neal children. But I look at it and I think, okay, now it's 65 years later, and I know a great purpose for offering that pole to the university, and my mother's heart was for this university to open their doors and be welcoming to Aboriginal students. And she had a great love and passion for all people, and she believed that we all needed to work together to come to the future that we're at now.
World of Education this Saturday, October 26th at the Vancouver Convention Center. You can meet with top universities, graduate schools, and professional schools from Canada and around the world. Register online to stay up to date and check in at the fair to be eligible for prizes, including a free flight to anywhere in the world on Air Canada. Explore your future with Study and Go Abroad this October 26th by registering now at studyandgoabroad.com/Vancouver/. studyandgoabroad.com/Vancouver/. It is time to get your spook on. And there's nothing like getting spooky with a good horror film. And this time, Slashback is coming right at you on October 24th. Slashback is a horror film that features Micah and her ragtag group of friends as they take on an alien invasion in their tiny Arctic hamlet. And it's up to them to fight back using makeshift weapons and horror movie knowledge. Arts Indigenous Student Advising is putting on Slashback. A film directed by an Inuit director and set in Nunavut, the horror film will be playing at the Norm Theatre this October 24th. Only $5 entry for public, and it's free for all UBC Indigenous students. Doors at 5:45 p.m. We'll see you at the Norm Theatre this October 24th.
Welcome back, everyone.
You're listening to Unceded Airwaves on CITR 101.9 FM in so-called Vancouver. Today we're talking about Indigenous students in UBC, and you just heard the video, The Power of a Name, The Thunderbird, and UBC, which is from a series called The Power of a Name, a UBC YouTube channel series. And it's kind of a We're Totally Reconciled Guys series. Mm-hmm. Yeah, UBC in researching has a lot of stuff. Like, they have a hidden history website where I feel that there's still a lot of stuff that isn't covered in the hidden history. Like, I know Santa Ono in his apology for residential schools acknowledged that UBC trained administrators and legislators. There's no mention of that on the hidden history website or expansion upon that. And I imagine there's a lot of other stuff as well. So it's very selected to what hidden histories mm-hmm. they want us to see. So trying to pull from that was hard. And first we'll talk about the importance of the potlatch ban. And in that video that we just watched, they mentioned that the pole was carved, it was actually illegally carved because the potlatch ban was in effect. And there was a lot of resistance at the time. That is, a lot of the art that we're able to enjoy now was illegally made by very resilient people. And so we'll start with importance of the potlatch ban in effect for the first 36 years of instruction at UBC, from the UBC Centennial.
In 1884 until 1951, the federal government banned potlatches under the Indian Act, with other ceremonies such as the Sundance to follow in the coming years. The potlatch was one of the most important ceremonies for coastal First Nations in the West, and marked important occasions, as well as served a crucial role in distribution of wealth. Non-native colonists and missionaries saw the sharing of wealth and food at potlatches as excessive and wasteful, but ultimately they knew how integral it was to sustaining First Nations cultures. Indian agents and missionaries felt it interrupted assimilation tactics. They wanted Aboriginal people to shift from an economic system of redistribution to one that,
what's
the word before property there?
Private.
Oh, there we go. Thank you. Sorry. To one of private property ownership, seemingly impossible as long as the potlatch existed.
So that's just to give a bit of context of what was happening in the first 36 years of UBC's history of time of instruction. Mm-hmm. Next, we'll start to go over some bits and pieces from UBC's, I think it's called the Aboriginal Relations Timeline. I'm not sure, but I've noticed that the term Aboriginal is used a lot here, which is outdated, insensitive, and we just don't use it anymore. Though it's not a slur, it's just not used, and it's outdated, and it's kind of seems to be mostly in use in like the 90s, early 2000s, and has since gone out of use. So we'll start with 1915.
Okay, so in 1915, UBC began offering courses. Then in 1925, UBC's Point Grey campus was built on the stolen, unceded, and occupied Musqueam land. In 1930, residential school enrollment across the country peaked, and UBC had around 1,900 students. In 1947, Harry Hawthorne was hired to address issues concerning Aboriginal peoples. That's a quote. And Harry Hawthorne founded the anthropology program at UBC in this year. In 1948 was the conference with Aboriginal leaders on Aboriginal peoples' human rights held at UBC. The conference includes Aboriginal leaders Chief William Scow, father of the first UBC law graduate Alfred Scow, Chief Andrew Paul, George Clutesi, and noted carver Ellen Neal. The event is chaired by UBC anthropologist Harry Hawthorne, and President Mackenzie welcomed representatives from many UBC departments, community leaders, and other supporters. Despite the paternalistic tone of some participants, others addressed the lack of human rights afforded to Indigenous peoples by white occupation and rule. Some topics under discussion include ways to reduce poverty, improve education, rekindle Indigenous cultural pride, and change broader social attitudes. A central theme of the conference is the importance of the attendance and success of Indigenous students at UBC to ensure long-term leadership in the province. At that time, UBC also hired Haida leader and United Church minister Peter Kelly to lecture on BC Coastal First Nations. Next, we're going to look at the impacts of the Indian Act at the time.
This is a quote. When Indigenous political organizing became more extensive in the 1920s and groups began to pursue land claims, the federal government added Section 141 to the Indian Act. Section 141 outlawed the hiring of lawyers and legal counsel by status Indians, barring Indigenous peoples from fighting for inherent rights through the legal system. That's just, sorry. Yeah. They really said.
It's very blatant.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's kind of unbelievable that they can just say you can't hire a lawyer. Eventually, these laws expanded to such a point that virtually any gathering was strictly prohibited and would result in jail time. These amendments presented a significant barrier to Indigenous political organizing, and many organizations had to disband. However, it did not entirely stop political organizing. Organizations such as the Niskas, I'm not completely sure how to...
Niska.
Niska's Land Committee, and the Native Brotherhood of British Columbia managed to continue to organize the fight for their rights underground. Then in 1961, Alfred J. Scow becomes the first Indigenous student to graduate from UBC Law and is later the first Indigenous lawyer called to the BC Bar and the first legally trained Indigenous judge appointed to the BC Provincial Court. In 2012, he wins the UBC Alumni Achievement Award. In 1970, Between 1963 and 1964, 57 status First Nations students enrolled in universities across Canada. The University of Calgary and Alberta are some of the first to offer Indigenous student services. More would follow in the 1980s and 90s. Some of the causes for increased enrollment are rising numbers of Indigenous high school graduates, federal funding specifically for Indigenous students, and the increase of First Nations courses such as the Native Teacher Education and Native Studies at UBC. And then in 1974, I can take that one unless you wanted to.
but
We'll try and get through the timeline.
Okay.
So in 1974, the Native Indian Teacher Education Program was established at UBC. It was created as an elementary teacher education program in response to the need within Indigenous communities in BC for a more relevant and effective education program. In 1975, First Nations Legal Studies was established at UBC. The goal of the Indigenous Legal Studies program is to encourage First Nations students entering the field of law and supporting their legal education. Since its inception, the program has had many notable graduates, including Judge Alfred Scow and Stephen Point, the Lieutenant Governor of BC. Since 1934, 750 status First Nations students have earned degrees in higher education. The number started to grow significantly in the 1960s. Out of the 750 students, 610 earned their degrees in the 1970s. Teacher's certificate is the most popular degree earned, followed by Bachelor of Arts in Nursing. In 1987, First Nations House of Learning established as a unit in the President's office. The goal of the FNHL is to ensure the accessibility of UBC resources to First Nations students and to provide a positive environment for First Nations, Métis, and Inuit students, staff, and faculty. The First Nations House of Learning logo was created by Tsimshian artist Glenn Wood. It consists of a human face surrounded by two ravens, which also forms the frame of a longhouse. The face is a humanoid with frog-like features and represents the First Nations people. The house design represents the university or house of learning. The raven is a symbol of creativity and learning.
In 1993, this was the grand opening of the First Nations Longhouse. The Longhouse serves as a home away from home where Indigenous students can study, gather, and learn. It also welcomes UBC and broader community members from various nations to gather and host events, learning opportunities, workshops, and more.
The architecture of the longhouse reflects a traditional Musqueam longhouse. The central administrative unit that resides in and directs the use of the longhouse is called the First Nations House of Learning, or the FNHL. It also provides student services, liaises with Indigenous communities, and leads strategic planning on UBC Indigenous initiatives. It is also the location for a wide variety of resources and services, including the Wewa Library, a study area, computer lab, social lounge, and tutoring, counseling, advising, and other student services. The Longhouse was the first university facility of its kind dedicated to Indigenous students.
In 1993, is it pronounced NTEP?
NTEP.
NTEP, okay. Transfers collection to the, sorry, and also is this, Huihua?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. I've only seen these things written, but the Huihua Library collection, the collection of the library begins with the Indian Education Resource Center in the early 1970s. The collection later became the Native Indian Teacher Education Program collection. When the First Nations House of Learning opened the new longhouse and library in May 1993, NTEP, right? Wait, yes, okay, thank you. Transferred the collection to the Huihua Library. In 1997, the launch of the First Nations Language Program happened. The First Nations Language Program, now the First Nations Endangered Languages Program, is initiated as part of UBC's commitment to community-based collaboration with First Nations peoples in recognition of the profound importance of First Nations languages and the rich cultures and tradition and the rich cultural traditions they represent.
In 1997, Dan Birch urges UBC Senate to promote admission of First Nations students. VP Academic Dan Birch brings a notion to the Senate to urge UBC to set itself the target of admitting 1,000 First Nations students by the year 2000. Dr. Kirkness, former director of the First Nations House of Learning, speaks in support of the proposal by Birch. In 1998, Trek 2000 aims to expand Indigenous studies in students. Trek 2000, UBC's strategic planning document, sets out a goal to increase the number of Indigenous students from around the world, including 1,000 Canadian First Nations students by fall 2000, and to develop a major in First Nations studies by spring 2001.
From this point, too many changes have been made to list them all, but they include the 2020 Indigenous Strategic Plan, the Huihua Library becoming an official branch of the UBC Library, the signing of the Musqueam Memorandum of Affiliation, the opening of the Indian Residential School History and Dialogue Center, the launch of the First Nations and Indigenous Studies Program, and many more. Next, we'll talk a bit about Indigenous student life today. So there are 2,389 Indigenous students enrolled at UBC with 48 Indigenous faculty members. There are various resources and lounges and these kinds of things like the Indigenous Student Collegia, the Longhouse, Student Lounge, Indigenous Academic Advising. We have Indigenous Student Tours, which are led by Indigenous advisors for incoming Indigenous students. And
And there's the Huihua Library, which sits adjacent to the Longhouse. It began in the 1970s with the founding of the Indian Education Resource Center, whose collection later came under the care of the Native Indian Teacher Education Program. Huihua Library is housed in a replica pit house, or kekuli, a traditional interior Salish dwelling where storytelling commonly took place in the winter, as this allowed for complex teachings to be properly told and understood.
And then, this is more discussion-based, but there's a lot of things about being an Indigenous student here at UBC. There's students who experience discrimination here for being Indigenous students and being racialized. There's common prejudice beliefs about, quote, easier admission. I've never been asked or anything like that, or had someone tell me that they had an assumption that it was easier for me, but I know that my brother, who's only 3 years older than me, experienced that a lot in his program in kinesiology, of people constantly questioning if he deserved to be here or not. And many students deal with that. I don't know if anybody has experiences with that here, but and tokenization by UBC, of UBC exploiting the labor of Indigenous students. And whatnot.
Yeah, for sure. I also have been really lucky, and I feel like I haven't experienced direct discrimination or like those sort of prejudice beliefs. I know like family members also, like older family members, when they were in school, that was something that they struggled with, and it has been something that I've just heard said more broadly, not directly to me. Kind of that things like priority and like residence housing or different scholarships or bursaries that are intended for Indigenous students are somehow an unfair advantage, when I think it's the absolute least the university could do, but you know.
Absolutely. I remember doing a like work experience program thing. UBC did like a trial run thing for Indigenous work learns last year, and I was a part of that. And in that, there was someone who did a speech, and he said something to everyone when talking about this. And he was like, no matter what people say, if they think you are here because you're Indigenous, you are here despite it. And I was thinking about that a lot, and how people really still, and a lot of people very casually hold these beliefs and wouldn't really say it, but do still secretly believe that it's easier, there's unfair advantages or benefits, and all of these really messed up things.
Or even just assuming that you're getting funding from the school.
Yeah.
When it's like, a lot of the time, if people are getting funded because they're Indigenous, it's not through the school at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's through the band. Which is like from the band's own money. And it's just, yeah, it can be very difficult. And I feel very lucky to be here in a time and to be a non-racialized student and not experiencing this kind of things. But the soldiers that came before us had to go through so much.
Yeah.
Like so, so much. And a lot of us are first gen, but there's some people whose parents did go and they lived to tell the tale. And it's very, very hard.
Yeah, and even like in the discussion, especially on like the stuff that's distributed by UBC, the information that's from UBC that we've read today, it's sort of, I feel like that there's very much a lens of like how lucky Indigenous students are versus like how it enriches the UBC environment. Right? Like it's just, it sounds more like bringing Indigenous students to the school is a benefit for them rather than the school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the tokenization is terrible. So there was this article by the UBC from 2020, and it was titled Indigenous Voices, Students on Their Experiences at UBC. And a past student named Mike Wesley said the following. There are some more apparent situations, like the culture change from having grown up on reserve with all my family around to not having my family around me or nothing really here. And things are often done differently than they'd be done in my culture. Often I am also the only Indigenous person in a lot of my classes, so that's kind of weird and challenging because people don't really understand where I'm coming from. I feel like nobody really understands the kind of thing, the kind of systemic racism battles the Indigenous people are dealing with.
He also said, there have been weird interactions with group partners where I would be challenged about my lived experience as an Indigenous person because they have all this theoretical knowledge that they have read about Indigenous peoples and the history of Canada. And those types of situations are really emotionally draining because it affects me more than it does the other person. I feel like people tend to think of colonialism as an event that happened in the past, but it's happening right now, thriving. And people think all this stuff happened a long time ago, but I'm actually the first generation to not go to residential school. My father went to residential school. He only survived because he's resilient like that. I have two children myself now, and somehow I came up off this reserve and I'm at this Ivy League school now. I'm just kind of proud that everything turned out this way and that I'm about to finish all of my education here.
It's a really good article, and it highlights just a bunch of students and their stories and their experiences at UBC, and I highly recommend for further reading.
He's so well-spoken, and that was a lot of good points there.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah, the group project stuff and the, like, being the only person in your class in the sea of people.
Yeah, and a lot of people, like, the part about the theoretical knowledge versus actually talking to an Indigenous person is very true. Like, there, despite all of the promotional things that we hear as UBC students, especially like on certain days or like maybe with like certain like landmarks on campus, but like the, I feel like the general population doesn't have like the necessary kind of understanding that he's talking about.
Absolutely. Next, we'll talk about some of the first Indigenous UBC students. And we'll start off with talking about Gloria Cranmer.
Born in Alert Bay, Gloria was the first Indigenous woman to attend the University of British Columbia, where she graduated with an anthropology degree in 1956. In 1971, she was hired as an assistant curator at the Museum of Anthropology, when the museum was still located in the basement of the UBC Main Library. It was at MOA that she learned of the 1921 potlatch hosted by her father. Sorry, I'm not sure of the pronunciation
This. Me neither.
Hereditary Chief Dan Cranmer. That was raided by federal and provincial authorities. The seized masks, rattles, regalia, and other family heirlooms were divided up and shipped east to various museums. Gloria became a passionate advocate for the return of these treasures, which became known as the Potlatch Collection. Along with other cultural leaders and community members, she prevailed in reparating most of the collection. She went on to help establish the Humista Cultural Center at Alert Bay in 1980, one of two permanent homes for the reparated belongings. The other is the Nuyumbalese Cultural Center at Cape Mudge, which opened in 1979. Gloria served as Humista's director and curator for many years. Gloria Cranmer Webster at Humista Cultural Center. Over the decades, and through her work at UMISTA, Gloria continued to contribute her scholarship and leadership to the MOA. She collaborated on research and curatorial projects with the MOA staff, offered public lectures, and hosted community visits at the museum.
Thank you, Gloria. Wow. The very first.
Incredible.
The next will be, it's from the Nisga Nation website, and it's an article called Honoring Our Past, Dr. Frank Calder. So here's a bit on Frank Calder. In 1915, a Nisga matriarch had a dream in the village of Ginkolks. Her dream was so powerful, she commanded a young man to row her 11 kilometers along the Nass River to the home of Chief Nagwaun, Arthur Calder. She carried urgent news for the chief's wife, Louisa. The matriarch told Louisa that her youngest sister Emily was pregnant with her third child. She had predicted that the child would be male and would bear the spirit of the son of Chief Nagwaun, and Louisa had lost earlier, drowned in the Nass. That baby boy was born on August 3, 1915 at Nass Harbor Cannery to Job and Emily Clark. By way of traditional adoption, he was raised by Chief Nagwaun and Louisa Calder.
As a baby, Frank Calder was presented to a gathering of elders discussing the issue of the Nisga land claim, a cause which some likened to an immovable mountain. There, Chief Nagwaun famously declared, "This boy is going to learn the laws of the Kamsiwa, the white people, and when he comes home, he's going to move the mountain." At the age of 7, Frank was sent south to Kokwalitsa Residential School at Sardis. He returned each summer, however, to fish the Nass with his father or work in the cannery. Frank's long and distinguished life was marked by a series of significant firsts. He was the first status Indian to study at Chilliwack High School, the first admitted to the University of British Columbia, and in 1949, Frank became the first quote-unquote Aboriginal person to be elected to British Columbia's legislature and the first appointed a minister of the Crown in Canada. Frank served in the legislature for 26 years. In 1952, Frank addressed the legislature and reminded his fellow members that they are newcomers in this land. He began by speaking in the Nisga language, paused and said, "Mr. Speaker, for those who have arrived in BC more recently," and continued in English. In 1955, after nearly a century, the Nisga Land Committee was reformed as the Nisga Tribal Council, and it elected Frank its first president. He served for 20 years.
Among Frank's many awards and honors are Officer Order of Canada, Aboriginal Order of Canada, inductee to Canada's First Nations Hall of Fame, Doctor of Divinity, Doctor of Laws, Licentiate in Theology, National Aboriginal Achievement Award, and President
Emeritus,
Nisga's Nation. Yet for all of his work and honors, Frank Calder will forever be remembered for his roles in the settlement of the Nisga's land question. Land question. And the 1973 Supreme Court of Canada's decision that bears the name. After the British Columbia Supreme Court and Court of Appeal both rejected the claim, the case was appealed to the Supreme Court of Canada and led to the Calder's decision.
This landmark decision established for the first time that Aboriginal title exists in modern Canadian law. The decision not only opened the possibility to a new future for British Columbia's First Nations, it reverberated across Canada and around the world. It provided the legal foundation on which the BC treaty process started after 113 years of opposition by provincial and colonial authorities and held to the landmark Nisga's final agreement, British Columbia's first modern treaty. The Calder case sought a clear declaration that the Aboriginal title of the Nisga people had never been extinguished. The case was led by Thomas Berger and ultimately argued before the Supreme Court of Canada with Aboriginal title as a sole issue. the justices were equally divided, with 3 in favor and 3 against. It is generally agreed that the first significant outcome of the Calder case was the famous dissenting judgment of Mr. Justice Emmett Hall, who was unequivocally placed responsibility for action back into the political sphere. The effect was to move the issue of Aboriginal rights and title onto British Columbia's and Canada's agenda. In 1973, Prime Minister Pierre Elliott Trudeau, who had long maintained that it was impossible to right historical wrongs, famously, quote-unquote, changed his mind and said that Aboriginal people, quote, had a lot more rights than I thought you did, but it will take us a decade to define what they are, unquote.
That sums it up.
Wow.
Take us a decade.
Even in the year 2000, as the final objections to the Nisga'a Treaty continued through the courts, Frank stood firm in the witness box, supporting the contention that the quote-unquote inherent right of self-government had survived Confederation. This was Frank in his 8th decade. The court agreed that all the rights set out in the Nisga'a final agreement are treaty rights that are protected under Canada's constitution. The Calder case is the backbone of current and future Aboriginal land claim negotiations in Canada. Prior to this landmark case, there was no clarified process for land claim settlements. No one was certain which lands were negotiable and which were not. This case resulted in 40% of Canada's land mass becoming negotiable and Canada launching a land claim policy to guide negotiations.
In the words of Iona Campagnolo, former Lieutenant Governor of British Columbia, few of us are privileged to change history. Frank Calder is one who has done so. Had there not been an honorable member for Atlin, elected in 1949 in the person of the Little Chief Frank Calder, and for his presence in the legislature of British Columbia, we would all today be the poorer. For his efforts, Frank was named Chief of Chiefs, an unprecedented tribute by all 4 Nisga'a clans. For his part, Frank Calder fulfilled the prophecy and helped, quote, move the mountain of land claims. He helped redress past injustice and secure a brighter future for British Columbia and Canada's Aboriginal peoples. He has left behind a freer, stronger, and ever grateful Nisga'a Nation. So that was on a few pretty notable Indigenous UBC students who were some of the first. So we had Frank Calder and Gloria Cranmer. And there was also... We're going to talk about another one, but that one I don't think we have time for. But we mentioned him earlier. He was the first Indigenous UBC law graduate. I'm trying to find his name in here now. Alfred Scow, and mm-hmm. his family had come up a lot in this, like his father, Chief William Scow, and that's another figure that could be worth looking into. So, do you have any further thoughts on Indigenous students in UBC before we wrap up? Yeah, other than just that UBC tokenizes and exploits and really wants to put out a specific image, even in their hidden histories that they put out.
Yeah, and one thing that I thought about while watching the video about the park and... while listening to what you were saying, is that when the premier was saying it's the largest urban park, whatever, and even some of the stuff that we've talked about, it shows how the government sees it as of value when it's like a mainstream or commercial thing. And like you said, they were trying to... switch people over to having individualistic beliefs and focus on like ownership and property. And like the premier only saw the forest as being like this great environmental and social thing when it was like a public commercial park. But when it was being used, it was still a forest, it's still environmentally beneficial, and it was being used for like thousands of years by Indigenous people for social and ceremonial things, but that didn't count at all. So yeah,
absolutely.
I also just wanted to say that just speaking of the first Indigenous students here and just all of UBC's history, I think Indigenous students still deal with so much at UBC, and we wouldn't be able to be here today without all the people who came before us. And I just want to say I'm very proud of the communities and spaces that we have been able to create and thrive in here, even though at times it's very difficult because we're obviously still in a colonial country and mm-hmm. institution and setting all day, every day, which is exhausting in its own right. But I think being able to be here at all and to thrive and to pursue what we're trying to pursue and find mm-hmm. kin and community despite all that and through all that is admirable, and I'm very proud of everyone for that.
Definitely. The like inter-nation, inter-community community that forms here as a result of so many people from so many different nations living through the same context makes me feel very proud and very happy to see all the space for us, and that there's been just so much labor put in and we get to reap a lot of the rewards here in 2024. I'm so grateful for these people. I can't even imagine what they would have gone through in everyday life of living through these classes and having to try and prove themselves constantly. Very, very grateful. And that would conclude today's episode on Indigenous students and UBC, specifically UBC Vancouver location, because there's other histories and stories with the Kelowna UBCO location in Silk Territory, but today we just got into UBC in so-called Vancouver. Thank you for listening, everyone. Hi.
Thank you.
Bye.